Now on News Talk, as part of our documentary on News Talk series, producer JJ O'Shea looks at how his childhood visits to Ireland informed his sense of identity in Home From Home.
I was born in London in 1950 and I grew up there, in counties Kilburn and Cricklewood, as they say. My parents were part of that generation of immigrants who left Ireland soon after the Second World War. But even though they'd settled in London and were raising four children with English accents, they always referred to Kerry as home and they always kept in close contact with that home. In fact, when you open the doors of our terraced house in Cricklewood, you could just as easily have been a few miles west of Tralee, rather than 5 miles north of Buckingham Palace. In the kitchen, steam from the bacon and cabbage would settle as a mist on the window. Pope John XXIII surveyed the scene from one wall, while a picture of the Sacred Heart hung from another, above the record player, from where the sentimental songs of Bridie Gallagher arose like sugar-coated signposts pointing back to Ireland.
I've just stepped in to see you all. Should I lonely stay a while? And I want to see how you.
The latest copies of The Kerryman and Ireland's Own and The Sunday Press were read and reread before they were finally thrown out. But even as a child, I could see that The Kerryman had a special place. None of the other newspapers came with anything like the same degree of ceremony. My father brought The Kerryman home every Friday evening after work, and after dinner, he would put on his reading glasses, sit down in his armchair and read aloud to my mother the Casa Gregory and Aoner School parish notes, with all the solemnity of a Reuters correspondent relaying dispatches from the front line, while I would sit listening and watching, curious but understanding none of it.
I long to sit along with you and while away the night with tales of yore and fairy lore beside your fire so bright.
Coming up to Christmas every year, a turkey would arrive in the post from Ireland. Can you even do that now? A homegrown bird wrapped in brown paper with maybe a plucked leg poking through at one end. It would have come from my father's sister Kit and her husband Jerry, and every summer we'd uproot from Cricklewood and head over to Kit and Jerry's farm to spend the entire school holidays there in a cochlear near Casa Gregory in West Kerry. Cousin Patrick was our age, but he wasn't always sure what to make of us.
We wouldn't get very much notice. My mum might mention a day or two before to tidy up the place and get it ready. She'd say, the Cricklewoods are coming. And we'd be all excited about it and change of activity around the place and that. And the day would come and you would arrive. And I suppose when we very early ages, we'd be trying to figure out who you were. And these people that came from this foreign land beyond the sea, you know, and I'd try to figure them out. And I suppose as the fella, oh, and he was telling the story of his own childhood, he would kind of start off like saying, Fado, Fado, and St. Sean, I'm sure the number of Amy Og, the Vime Anna August, there'll be a Breach de Gar on them. The Breach de Gar being the short trousers. And that time, well, there was an unwritten rule. Certainly here in West Kerry, if and in many other parts of Ireland, that you didn't wear a long trousers until you were confirmed. And you'd be told that the bishop would come along and he'd give you a slap across the jaw and he'd make you a strong and perfect Christian. And that entitled you to wear a man's trousers and then you could wear a long trousers. And it was fully accepted. And this went back, I suppose, to my dad and his dad and his dad before him. And we grew up with it and we never questioned it. But along the cousins came anyway from Cricklewood, and they were wearing these funny kind of trousers. They were long blue trousers with very distinctive different coloured threads on the pockets of them and that, and maybe a bit of leather stitched onto the back pocket, called jeans. And we'd never heard or seen of these before, and we wondered, you know, what these people that were wearing them, and we thought, you know, England must surely be a pagan country where young lads are allowed to wear long trousers and aren't even confirmed yet.
My brothers and sister, the trip was the highlight of the year, a real adventure. But we weren't the only summer visitors to Acoshla. Uncle Jerry's nieces and nephews from Fermanagh would arrive too. Anne McGovern remembers their journey down.
It wasn't the luxury coach all the way to the south of Ireland, 300 miles away. I don't even remember packing a bag, but I'm sure there were clothes packed at some stage. We would have all got dressed and piled into the back of the van. It was a big, a Ford van. No seating in the back, no seat belts. We just all piled in. We had cushions or rugs maybe on the floor of the van. And we set off early in the morning. After the milking was done and down the road with all the bumps. It had to be a very bumpy ride because the roads were very, very bad. And the Kerry folk used to talk about the good roads up north, and we certainly knew what they were talking about. The roads on the way down were so, so rough and twisted and bendy. But I never, ever remember anybody complaining in the back of that van. And we were in there for hours. It might have taken maybe 6 hours travelling down. But then as you come on down through the Midlands, Athlone, down into Limerick, gosh, when you got to Limerick, you thought you were nearly there. But in actual fact, you weren't. You had a considerable... That was really about just two-thirds of the way. So... come on down through Limerick and then onto the Kerry border. And once we recognised the signs, you know, Kerry, and we recognised the signs for Tralee and whatever, well, the cheer went up. And I'm sure it was deafening.
And for us, travelling from London, the journey was even longer. When I think of what it was like for my mother and for others like her travelling overnight to Ireland with their families in the 1950s, the trains and the boat, the four of us children pulling out of her all the way, and this in the days before disposable nappies, I don't even want to remember how that was managed, and the night boat sailing in the small hours but with nobody interested in sleep. There was always a great sense of excitement and anticipation on the boat, a mood that couldn't be dampened by even the roughest crossing, and there were plenty of those. You see, people would have been waiting for this all year. It wasn't like today when you can hop over on a whim or have a chat on Skype. Even telephone calls weren't a simple process. I remember the boat pulling into Dunleary with everyone gathered up on the decks, bleary-eyed but still shouting and joking, the grey dawn just beginning to break, and the sharp tang of sea air mixed with the smell of diesel as the boat rocked towards the stout wooden pier, the harbour lights drawing nearer and nearer. And for me, nothing has ever tasted as good as breakfast on the train, as we were finally heading down to Kerry after that long night. It's always been a mystery to me how our Aunt Kit managed in the house with all of us. There must have been relays at the dinner table. I mean, there were just so many of us.
On one particular night, I distinctly remember 22 of us sleeping in a hostler. That would have included my parents and my granny and her son and his wife, Auntie Kit, Uncle Jerry and Auntie Kit, and then all the cousins and friends who had arrived home And my uncle, I think, arrived in from Tipperary, my mother's brother, Uncle Jack, and there was no bed, there was no place for him. It's not that there was beds for everybody, but there might have been half a dozen children in each bed, top and bottom, three in one end and three on the other end. And, you know, people slept on the sofa and on the couch and whatever. And my Uncle Jack came in and there was no place for him. So he took the wooden table and turned it upside down and slept. He slept in the table, probably a couple of coats over him.
And we just have so much freedom, so different to our city life. Our parents could just leave us off to run down the fields.
You know, you go off for hours playing and there was nobody worrying about you or looking for you. It was just a very carefree time, very carefree. There weren't many cars about. We were only a 5-minute race to the Strand. We didn't call it the beach, we called it the Strand. And once you went down the Boreen, down onto the what we call the Low Road, and the Low Road, you crossed over the Low Road, and that was, you were on the banks. You were there on the Strand, the Atlantic Ocean, right beside our door. And, of course, on our way to the Strand, we'd have been shouting and playing and cahoeing, and the neighbours all came out. Jule, she'd come out and she said, "Oh, you must be Nell Shea's daughter." Of course, they recognised the Fermanagh accent. And we were brought in and given, you know, drinks and sweets and biscuits and just whatever was there. We were made so, so welcome. Everybody owned us. The neighbours all owned us.
We never missed the amenities we'd left behind. There was no running water on the farm, no television. Radio was only a recent acquisition, and Patrick didn't entirely trust it at first.
Here in Kerry, with football being what it was and what it still is to us, and a crowd of people would come into the house the day of an All-Ireland final and that, and sit around and listen to the radio and that. And I remember being there as a young child, and I listened very intently to the radio. And if I remember, Kerry were playing Galway in an All-Ireland final, and we'd won the match, and there was great excitement, and I was really delighted that Kerry had won. But I wanted to make absolutely sure. So up I got out the door and ran down the Boreheen and over to Patsy Connor and ran in the door, jaded, inquiring off of Patsy to know who won on his radio. What if Kerry won on our radio and he won on his radio, then there was a fair chance they did really win it.
Cousin Patrick was naturally curious about our lives.
We would compare you and your way of life to ours, and, you know, and what was life like in London and how much it was different than it was from here in Aucashla. And on this farm here in Aucashla, anybody who lived in the farm had to work on the farm, and you only know that too well yourself from coming on holidays here, and you were giving the pike out, making hair, doing turf or weeding or anything like that. And I remember sitting down one day and I was talking to your sister tomorrow about it and wondering, you know, what do you do in England? And did you have the life of Riley that you didn't have to look after it and do all this work in the evening after school or holidays and so on and so forth? And I wondered, you know, was it a good thing or was it a bad thing? You know, I'd love to have a few days off and do nothing myself, but I thought, would it get boring after a while or what it would be like? And I wasn't sure. And we were talking about, you know, my life and what I was doing in the farm, and I was putting this pointer, you know, that he'd agreed. And I asked her, did you have any animals? And she says, yes, we have a cat. And I thought, a what? And she said, a cat. Now, to me, a cat wasn't an animal. I don't know what it was. It's probably just a cat. I mean, an animal was a cow or a heifer or a calf or a bullock or a horse or a pony or a donkey or something like that. But the cat didn't justify being called an animal anyway. And I kind of sarcastically, and I said, and who looks after this cat? And she said she did, and I wondered, you know, should she have a wheelbarrow and a four-pronged pike to clean out from the cat, you know, and bed it and do all the kind of work we were doing? And I asked, you know, would you tell me what was involved in looking after this cat? I mean, and she said yes, that she had to look after the cat and that she'd go to the shop and that she'd go shopping for the cat. Well, by God, this, I couldn't understand it at all. So I'm going shopping for a cat? I mean, a cat came into the house and he was hunted out the door. And the cat, like everybody else on the farm, had to work for his keep. There was vermin, and it was his job to go out and catch them. And while a cat would be fed a little, he certainly wouldn't be overfed because he had a job to do and he had to do it. But the thoughts of somebody going to the shop for a cat was far beyond it.
Maureen remembers that conversation too.
I can remember telling Patrick about how we had this cat in London, and the food we would get from it would be from the shop in a tin called Whiskers. Purple it was, with a big picture of a cat on the front. And his eyes popped right out of his head and he threw his head back laughing. He couldn't believe that such a thing existed, that you actually went into the shop and paid good money for a tin of food that was just for the cat, no one else. And I think it brought it home to me, the difference between London and a Cosla, between Cricklewood and a Cosla, and the way of life. There was something about when he burst out laughing about the cat food that it brought it home to me, that the huge difference in the way of living, that this cat in London was a pet and all he had to do was meow for his food.
However, not everything we learned in Ireland translated easily back into our London lives, as my brother Michael discovered at school.
I'd say we were 9 years old and the teacher was doing this vocabulary building thing like, do you know what we call a young sheep? The answer was lamb, of course. It was like he presented it like a game show. You'd put up your hand and you'd get a point if you had the right answer. So, do you know what we call a young cow? And a lad put up his hand and he got it, you know, calf. Then, do you know what we call a young horse? And I think someone got the answer wrong. They said pony instead of foal. And then he came to one. Do you know what we call a young pig? So my hand went up like a shot. I was pleased because I knew I had the right answer and I was first. And he said, OK, O'Shea, what is it? And I said, a bunnev. And he said, a what? And I said, a bunnev. And he said, where did you hear that word? And so, of course, I explained that on many occasions I've been with my mum and dad visiting their brothers and sisters on various farms in West Kerry. And on more than one occasion, there'd be a sow there with a load of bunnevs, you know. And so I'd heard the word and I'd seen them. And so it didn't occur to me that this might not be the word used in England. And the teacher said to me, where did you hear that? And I explained and he said, well, with a smile, he said, I'll take your word for it, but I can't give you a point for that, which, as you can imagine, I was very disappointed by. And I've always felt that the word piglet is a bit of a mediocre word because it's not like foal or lamb or calf, a word in its own right, but just a sort of made-up word.
Anne's life in Fermanagh was very different to ours. At the time, I don't think we realised just how different. Simple, everyday things in the south would surprise her. For example, her daily experience of the RUC and the B specials at home was not a happy one. And she was very surprised to see the easygoing relationship everyone seemed to have with the local police around Castle Gregory.
I think the one memory I have, very, very distinct memory, is how the everybody chatting the guards, including my parents, and they seemed to be very much part of the community and on first name terms. And that I found in such a contrast to at home in Fermanagh, because once you saw the police on the road, well, you know, you're hyperventilating, wondering, what are they going to stop us for now? Are we going to be searched? You know, what's the problem? You always anticipated trouble. Maybe that was just exaggerated in my mind as a child. But it was just a totally different relationship altogether. You know, your lips were sealed. If you were asked any questions, you're almost reluctant to give your name. You see, you bear in mind, in the 50s, there was a lot of trouble in the north, and I will always remember the night that Sean South was shot in Brookborough and Fergal O'Hanlon. And, you know, at night, we didn't have electricity that time, but the lamp was lit, the tilly lamps were lit, and you brought them to the room. But the windows had to be blackened out, the curtains had to be closed, no light visible on the outside, everything in darkness. And the night of the raid in Brookborough, we could clearly, it was a very quiet night. Obviously, the wind was blowing our direction, and that would have been maybe a 15-minute drive away. So you're talking about 12 miles away, 13 miles away, and you could hear the shooting. It was all very brief, but it was such a burst of fire, and we could hear the whole racket.
And the situation affected their lives in all sorts of unexpected ways.
My granny died around that time as well, 28th of January 1957. And she was living in Antrim with Daddy's sister that time. And we had no phone, so the police came to the house with the message to say she had died. And I remember my father standing crying and deliberating about bringing her back home to Fermanagh to be buried with her husband, with my granda. But it was decided against that then, because how were they going to get the remains from Antrim down to Fermanagh all that journey? The roads were blown up, the B specials were on the road, everybody would have been diverted and vehicles searched, and even the hearse would have been searched. And it was just, with all the hassle, it was just decided best to bury my granny up in Antrim.
Perhaps the tension in the north gave the notion of also having a home in Kerry an extra appeal.
I laugh at this term, come home. It's very Irish, isn't it? They were coming home from Cricklewood. Our folks were coming home from Fermanagh. Home was Kerry. And that was always how my mother referred to it, as going down home.
But it's hardly surprising that young Patrick found all this talk of home confusing.
Yeah, I remember one time, and it was probably the day before you went back and that, and I'd asked you the question, when were you coming home again on holidays? And you said, no, we're going home tomorrow. And I thought, no, but when are you coming home again on holiday? And you said, no, we don't come home on holiday. We live at home. We live in London, and we come to Ireland on holiday. And I thought, no, I mean, this young lad isn't getting it at all. I mean, his mom comes home, his dad comes home, and it's only logical if his mom is coming home and his dad is coming home. He must be coming home, but he doesn't know it.
You're listening to Home From Home on Documentary on News Talk.
I don't mean to imply that our summers in Kerry were a golden, unbroken chain of bucolic bliss. It's true, as Anne said, that the neighbours all owned us and there was a real sense of belonging. But the neighbours were also entitled to give us a clip around the ear if they felt we'd earned it, no questions asked. And we young cousins argued and fought between ourselves, as children will, with rivalries that were all-consuming while they lasted. And work was hard on the farm in those long summer days. Everyone was expected to help, children included, whether it was saving the hay or stacking the turf or bringing in the cattle in the morning and evening. You'd build up an appetite, let me put it that way. But the breakfast came fresh from the hen house and the dinner was fresh from the field. And there'd be sweets on Sunday after Mass in Castle Gregory, where the sixpenny ice cream wafer was twice the size of anything you'd get in London for the same money.
And I remember great big chunks of toffee and you'd have been banging them on the windowsill or on the pillar, trying to break them up into little pieces. But so there were so many, I mean, you wouldn't have, everybody got a little piece. There were so many with the hands out.
Elsewhere, they were sending men into space.
Yuri Gagarin reported back to Earth how he was feeling and how the flight was going on. During these brief communications, the Soviet astronaut sent messages. I see the Earth. Visibility good. I hear you perfectly. And sometime later, the flight is continuing well. I see the Earth. Visibility good. Some space is covered by cumulus clouds.
Somehow the story of Yuri Gagarin, the first man to orbit the Earth, seemed much further away in Akosla than it had in London. There weren't even that many cars around West Kerry in the early 1960s. We all fought for a place in the trap going to Sunday Mass, although more often than not, Patrick and I ended up walking and tended to be luckier, for which I hope that one day I will be able to forgive her.
We queued up. We queued up to get into this trap. The more it would only have held six of us, you know, a couple of adults and a couple of children. And but you were bursting to get in first, to get sitting up near my uncle. And if you were very good, he would allow you to put your hand to hold the rein, one of the reins. And as we drove back to Castle Gregory, we went the low road. It was parallel to the sea. You know, you had the breeze of the sea, lovely warm breeze from the sea in your face, blowing your hair, the crunch of the horse's hooves and the trap wheels, on the rough road. We used to cross this little stream, back the low road. And it was lovely to hear the horse sort of clunking through the water. And we rocked from side to side. Arriving into the village, you were looking about, hoping everybody could see us.
I remember my teachers at school in Cricklewood being very excited about, well, first the election of President Kennedy and then his visit to Ireland. It was a Catholic school and most of the children were, like myself, the sons and daughters of immigrants who'd go home to Ireland every summer. So it didn't seem so unusual to us that this other returning son should head there too.
The President of Ireland and the Taoiseach are at the foot of the steps, and any moment now we will have the arrival. Yes, here he comes down the steps to a tremendous welcome, the 35th President of the United States of America, John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
When we were considered old enough to be let go to the Sunday night dance in Castle Gregory, that felt like a big step.
My first experience of a dance as such would have been, now we weren't very old, we'd have been early teens, and going back to Castle Gregory to the hop in a very old, sort of dilapidated, wagon-roofed hall, corrugated iron, and a very shabby door. And even inside, I remember the walls, that smell of dampness, and you could see the traces of dampness on the wall, I suppose, because the paint was flaking. And the floor was well and truly worn, wooden floor. And it wouldn't have been your choice of venue, maybe, if appearances mattered. But we didn't care, because we had our cousins with us and we were looking forward to meeting the neighbours and seeing the talent and just having a great night's crack. It didn't matter where it was, whether it was in a hall or on the crossroads or whatever. Of course, we'd have spent half the evening getting ready, you know, getting the hair done and getting the rollers in the hair. And I'd have put in the rollers for my cousin, and she'd have put in the rollers in my hair and sprayed until it wouldn't move. It wasn't hairspray, it was lacquer. And lacquer just left your hair so solid. And, you know, picking out this dress, there was no problem picking a dress because you probably only had one, but it was ironed, and getting a bit of makeup on. What was that? Lipstick and powder, literally. And the lipstick was used as rouge.
The era of the show bands, but if there was a heavy shower of rain, or worse, hail, hitting off that old corrugated metal roof, the noise of it could nearly drown out the band.
When you walked into the hall, you had the boys on one side and the girls usually on the right-hand side, and the boys, it must have been quite an experience for them, because the boys had to cross over the floor to ask a girl to dance, and they weren't always sure whether that girl would accept the invitation or not. So the poor fella, he could have had to maybe make a quick exit if he was refused. But in those days, it was the man who asked the girl to dance, and it was considered the height of ill manners to refuse. You really weren't supposed to refuse a man.
As soon as the music started, there'd be a rush, a gallop across the floor. And you'd have your eye on somebody to ask to dance. And if somebody beat you there, you'd have to stop and hesitate. Where do I go from here? And it could be too late. I don't know why, but I never counted them, but there always seemed to be more fellas than girls at the dances anyway. And you'd dance, and I suppose there was almost a certain amount of kind of what was called duty dances. You'd meet someone the following day, you didn't give me a dance last night, or you didn't, and you'd kind of go through your duty dances for time to give her another dance, and then you might relax and say, well, now we'll see where the rest of the night takes us. And then you'd get up and you'd ask somebody to dance, and the dance was three songs, and that was the end of it. And you would be thanked for dancing, and then you would all go and sit down and back to your own side of the hall again and ready for the next charge when the music started up again. And you might ask, well, then if you were dancing and things were going all right, you might ask her to keep the next dance for you. And she'd say she would, and it's a good sign anyway. Things might be all right. And then you'd have to go across the road, and then you'd have to make sure that the gallop was straight for her the next time.
There was no alcohol. It was there was a mineral bar, and they would have also sold crisps as well. So if there was a fella who really fancied you, he'd say, "Would you like a mineral?"
What next? We won't ask. But in any case, in the early hours, there'd be the long walk home in the dark. You'd be hoping for a moonlit night to better see the road. And despite the jokes and laughter, we'd always move a bit faster past the old haunted orchard on the lower road. And I'd be reminded of stories my mother had told about travelling for miles on foot or bicycle to the local dances when she was young, including this story about a forbidden dance.
It was Lent time, and the usual bigger dances were not opened at all during Lent. The priest wouldn't allow them to be opened. So they closed, but this young man had an old farmhouse and he opened it up, and some friends of his and neighbours would come with piano corders or maybe fiddle, and they'd play music all night, and the young boys and girls would enjoy themselves dancing around all night. But then the priest found out that they were doing that, and he came along one night, and of course when they had him coming, they all ran different directions, and he was hunting them all around. And one girl was making her escape to a field when she lost her shoe, and then the priest get it. So the poor girl had to turn back and own up that she was one of the ones that was in the dance.
In London in the 1950s and 60s, and even after that too, there was a serious problem for followers of Irish football and hurling. There was no way of receiving Irish television, and so no way of watching your county play live. You couldn't even get a good reception for Irish radio. But there was a kind of solution. It was just about possible, with a bit of creative thinking, to rig up a system whereby you could listen on longwave radio. It involved stacking as many portable radios as could be found around the base of the telegraph poles that lined the streets. The pole acted as an aerial, and it was a common sight on Sunday afternoons in the summer to see a large crowd of people huddled around a telegraph pole in one of the back streets, heads bowed, listening intently to the distant crackled voice of Mihal O'Hare coming through the ether. My brother Eugene remembers one such match at Dublin Kerry semi-final. It was close, close, close. Just one point between the two teams and only a couple of minutes to go. So tension was high around the telegraph pole in Glengore Road, Kilburn, NW6.
There was about 30 of us. We were on a street corner, residential area. We weren't causing any great obstruction. Nevertheless, a young policeman came along and felt that technically we were breaking the law and that we needed to be moved on. So all on his own, he came up to us and he started chatting away and saying, well, no, you'll have to move away from here. And I was thinking, well, there's not long left in this game. I don't think anybody really wants to leave here right now. What's going to happen next? Well, nothing happened next because just nobody responded. It was an amazing thing to observe this irate policeman and this group of people who were just totally ignoring him. He tried two or three times to asking us, telling us to move along. No response. Not a word from anybody. It's the same thing as if the man wasn't there. He was a young policeman, not much experience, I'd imagine, straight out of college probably. And so he got on his walkie-talkie, and a couple of minutes later, along comes the squad car. Now, the squad car had a couple of much older policemen in the front of it. They'd been round the block a few times. So they took a look at us. They had a fair idea what we were up to. And they had a look at the young cop as well. Then one of them leaned over out the window of the car and he said, hey lads, is there long left in the match? Somebody put three fingers up to indicate 3 minutes. And he said, okay. And he indicated to the young cop to sit into the back. And the police took 4 minutes to drive around the block. We took 3 minutes to listen to the end of the game, which Kerry lost. We walked away disappointed, and by the time the cops came back, there wasn't a single soul on that corner.
As the 60s wore on, things were coming to a head in the North. Civil rights issues were moving centre stage. It seems incredible to me now that a country like England, that prides itself on its democratic institutions, should have so recently had a system that was plainly and utterly undemocratic. I'm talking about the local election system in Ulster, where it wasn't a case of one man, one vote. You could have more than one vote, depending on the amount of property or businesses you owned. And guess which section of the community that favoured? and the imbalance of power led to the abuse of power. For example, council houses were allocated primarily on the basis of religion, with the cards stacked against you if you happened to be Catholic.
There was a family who, a lady who had been widowed. She had a large young family, and she should have been allocated a particular house, a new council house in Lisnaskey. And it was allocated to a man, a single man, who already had a good home in the country. And I remember the locals considering, it's time we took action, it's time we took a stand on this. And my father was one of those people involved in organising the protests. And they had a sit-in in the new house before the gentleman concerned arrived. And they sat it out and they insisted that this young family, who were on the side of the road, the husband was dead, they had no way of paying rent, they needed accommodation, and they sat it out. So that was really the start of it all, where people were taking a stand. They couldn't tolerate the discrimination any longer.
But the winds of change did seem to be blowing.
Sean Dagnan here with the news at 1:30. And first, for the main headline news, over to Andy O'Mahony.
Miss Bernadette Devlin, who has won the Mid-Ulster by-election, goes to Westminster on Monday, 2 days before her 22nd birthday. Miss Devlin will take part in a big victory rally in Carrickmore tonight, and tomorrow she'll speak at a civil rights meeting in Lurgan.
The election of Bernadette Devlin was an extraordinary event. At the time, she was the youngest woman ever elected to the British Parliament, and she was a strong voice as well as a young one, unintimidated by those in power. Her election and her rallying call did send out ripples of hope.
People of Mid-Ulster, we have finally started to overcome.
But the path to social justice was to prove to be a long one, and as the 1960s moved into the 70s, those of us in London had to ask ourselves some serious questions.
The whole sort of Irish-English thing, or coming to understand your own identity, when I was younger, that it was a much more immediate familial thing that you're trying to sort out. Which side of the Irish Sea are you from, and what, how English are you, or how Irish are you? But that's a family thing. When you're older, of course, you become more aware of bigger issues, wider issues of identity. And of course, I'm thinking of the mid 70s, when the Northern Ireland conflict was probably at its worst in a lot of respects. You're talking about the period when the Birmingham bombings took place, when the IRA campaign was moved to Great Britain, and the car bombing that was common in the north prior to that was now becoming common in London, and the impact that that had on people like me, London Irish, who are trying to figure out, which side are we on? Are we supposed to be on a side, or are we supposed to be a bridge between the two sides? Very difficult to properly figure it out. Now, at that time, I was living in Kilburn, and certainly to pass between Holyhead and Dunleary generally involved being cross-examined by the police and having to explain your movements. Similarly, walking along the high road at the wrong time of night could lead to a cross-examination. So it was a difficult time, and it did force me and us and others, I'm sure, into asking yourself, where do you fit into this whole story?
You see, with names like Sullivan, O'Connor and O'Shea, we'd be considered Irish by our English neighbours. But with our English accents, back in the land of our glorious ancestors, we'd be the returned Brit or a plastic paddy. I'm so glad that our parents were able to give us a taste of their way of life before it disappeared. I'm proud of my Irish background, and I feel connected to Ireland in a real way. I grew up listening to stories and songs from Ireland every bit as much as my cousins in Kerry, and I'm sure my Irish background informs my way of seeing and relating to the world. I feel at home under the changing Irish skies, and I miss them when I'm away. And I probably have more in common with those of my generation who grew up in Ireland and remember the old ways than they do with the young Irish of today, for whom the past is a foreign country. But are these the things that give meaning to our lives, make us feel comfortable in our own skin, at home in ourselves? I'm not so sure. And I don't mind if you call me a plastic paddy. It won't keep me awake at night. Actually, it reminds me of Plastic Bertrand. Is Misha J.J. O'Shea, Slán agus Beannacht.
Sur mon lit à bouffer sa langue en buvant, prends mon whisky quant à moi, peu dormi, vie débris, mais j'ai dû dormir dans la gouttière où j'ai eu un flash.
Home From Home was produced and presented by J.J. O'Shea. Audio news clips were courtesy of RTE Archives. The programme was supported by a grant from the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland as part of the Sound and Vision Scheme. To listen back to this or any other News Talk documentary, go to newstalk.com/documentary on News Talk.